Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this Ask Me Anything with Matthew Slater of CreditCommons.net. As I'm sure you know, he co-authored the Credit Commons white paper with Tim Jenkin in 2016. And this session is mostly a Ask Me Anything Q&A type structure. So there'll be a bit of discussion, but primarily we want to make space for as wide a range of questions as possible. So if you have a question, please just send it to me privately in the chat, and I'll make sure it gets to Matthew. I'll just introduce myself very briefly, because I'm actually quite new to the whole concept of mutual credit. I've come here in quite a roundabout way. I've been very concerned since I was a teenager about all the ecological problems we've been facing, and I was aware that economics was at the root of these problems, and of course many others as well. But it was very clear to me even as a teenager that since economists couldn't actually agree on anything amongst themselves, even some fairly fundamental stuff, me going off to university and studying economics for 4 years was not a particularly good use of my time. So I ended up training as a physicist, and after completing my PhD last year, of course, all of the problems I was concerned about as a teenager had got a hell of a lot worse. And so I ended up joining Extinction Rebellion and spent a few months earlier this year working full-time as a coordinator for Scientists for Extinction Rebellion. And we did a lot of good work explaining the science of the climate and ecological emergency to people within the movement and outside. But the economy rarely came up. And I started to get increasingly frustrated by the fact that conversations about biodiversity loss would go so far as acknowledging that we have to end the perpetual growth economy and move to something more like a steady state or even degrowth economy. But there was no real discussion about how we might do that, or even what the fundamental drivers of perpetual growth are, even though almost everyone recognizes it's a problem and it's simply not sustainable. And so I started looking into alternative economics, and I had been aware of mutual credit primarily through the writings of Dave Darby on lowimpact.org for a number of years. But when I started reading deeper, I realized that actually this is a very, very exciting field because there are a lot of very interesting and powerful ideas out there, but also a lot of excellent practice going on. And this really seemed like something I felt I could help out with. And so I got in contact with the people behind the Open Credit Network and basically volunteered to help out. And so I've spent the last couple of months educating myself about community currencies, but also about how the mainstream monetary system works. And so I finally have had a chance to study economics through the lens of mutual credit. And I'm happy to say that some of it does actually make sense if you know what to pay attention to. So like I said, this has been a very empowering and exciting journey for me, and I've still got a lot to learn, so I'm very excited about this Q&A with Matthew Slater. So like I said at the start, I'll be moderating this session, and if you have any questions, please send them to me in the private chat. I will select them, and then you can ask your questions directly to Matthew, or if you prefer not to, simply say so, and I will pass them on to him for you. And of course, the public chat is open for discussion, but I will not be monitoring it. So to get the discussion started, I'm actually going to put a question to Matthew, which I'm very curious about, and that will also give you a bit of time to come up with some of your own questions. And so, yeah, as I said, I'm very new to all this, but of course, Matthew has been working on these systems in theory and in practice for many, many years. And what I'd really like to know is, from all of this experience, what has surprised you most about working with mutual credit systems?
Thanks, Tom. I didn't expect a question like that at all. For me, mutual credit contains a kind of geometric elegance that you don't get with fiat money and commodity money. The idea that all accounts add up to zero is a way of knowing that the economy is balanced. And when you have commodity money and fiat money, the job of an economist, at least from a monetary policy perspective, is to try to work out how much of that stuff needs to be created for the optimum functioning of the economy. And in mutual credit, that's just not a question, because the money, as it were, doesn't have a quantity. It's just ledger entries. There is a sort of quantity, which is the amount of credit and the amount of positive balances on people's accounts, but it's constantly adjusting. You could say that it was fully elastic in monetary policy terms, and it just broadens and narrows according to the needs of the economy. So there's no policy needed about how much credit can be created. There is some policy needed around the balance limits. So every account in a mutual credit account has to have a minimum and a maximum limit, which is like an indicator of how much they are trusted both to pay back what they have already spent and to earn back. So I'm getting this the wrong way around. It's an indicator of the trust they have to earn back what they have already spent and to spend back what they have already earned. So that's kind of the equivalent in monetary policy. But it's a very different question, because it's not a question of, well, how much money shall we issue on behalf of the economy today? It's a question of how much can this account be trusted by the rest of the community to earn or to spend back to zero. And I've analyzed this a bit in writing, but this idea of zero, everything comes back to zero. Everything is balanced. All the credit is balanced with the debt. All the supply is balanced with the demand. It's very, very elegant. And that's a constant source of joy to me in working with this. When I say working with it, I'm writing software a lot of the time.
Thank you very much for that, Matthew. I haven't yet had any questions come through to me privately, but you know, this is very much your chance to ask Matthew literally anything you've always wanted to since taking the MOOC. But whilst you are thinking of some questions, I've got lots, so I'll go in for another one. And this is actually my most common experience so far when I talk to people about mutual credit, and of course, you know, bearing in mind that it's a new field to me. When I start explaining it to people, within a couple of minutes, inevitably, they say, oh, so it's just like some kind of cryptocurrency. People's immediate assumption is that this is some kind of, you know, twist on Bitcoin. And of course, it's not. It has a lot of, which are very, very different to any cryptocurrency. But I was wondering, in your opinion, Matthew, what are the most important differences? And also, how do you explain them to people? How do you make it clear that this is very, very different to cryptocurrency?
That's a massive question, and I haven't ever attempted to answer it all in one gulp, because usually I'm trying to address one particular facet, one particular argument, one particular metaphor. What I usually say is that mutual credit is in a different paradigm to almost all the cryptocurrencies. The main exception in cryptocurrencies is Ripple and its open source version Stellar, where they do deal with credit and trust. But all the other cryptocurrencies have this idea of money as a commodity, or if not a commodity, at least a token, where a quantity of them is issued. Whether that be through mining or pre-mining, it's still a very fixed quantity. Some of them have some elasticity built in. And then they have to be distributed to the users. And Bitcoin, they're distributed through the mining process. Other cryptocurrencies will have things like airdrops, but it still always raises a problem as to the equity of the distribution, because it's like essentially giving assets away. You've created something, you declare it to be an asset, it needs to get into circulation. So you've got this problem about how do you distribute them? Do you make people earn them? If you make people earn them, then that means they're kind of working for you as the issuer of the currency. Well, that's hardly socially just. And the way that this problem is solved in a just way is that you lend them to people. You can create tokens and lend them to people, probably without interest, since you have the privilege of creating the tokens. You don't want to capitalize on it through interest. And then people can have use of the tokens until such time as they pay them back or they're demanded back. And that way, you have a more commons approach to the distribution of the money. But the distribution is only one thing. The Credit Commons implementation I built isn't a cryptocurrency at all. It's not a blockchain. It uses a little cryptographic hash to ensure that different independent ledgers are connected up and aligned, and that they have the same record, that they're essentially storing the same account, but on two different systems. That doesn't really make it a cryptocurrency. Mutual credit systems have been around for much longer than Bitcoin, and it's arguable that they're still much more used than Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies. They have found a real world application in a way that the cryptocurrencies arguably haven't. And that real world application is in the business partner networks and in the LETs and in the time banks, all of which I try to focus on. So the fundamental paradigm difference is in what's called the credit theory of money versus the commodity theory of money. Those things have different names because they have both reoccurred and have run parallel throughout history, raising their heads at different moments with different expressions. So cryptocurrencies are basically in the commodity money paradigm, even though you imagine that commodity money is worth something like gold, and yet they're just issuing tokens which are not worth anything on the face of it. And they find a market value like a commodity because they have supply and demand. While the credit commons is, as the name suggests, in the credit money paradigm. And there are different ways of working with credit, of guaranteeing credit, of issuing credit. But the idea is in all of those that the money doesn't exist as a thing, and that for every asset that you're passing around the economy as a medium of exchange, there's somewhere else in the economy a liability. It'll be on a balance sheet somewhere, and that the two eventually have to come back together. And in the credit money paradigm, anyone or only certain people can create the units of currency out of nothing. And so it means you have a monetary policy tool that enables you to control the money supply, which you might not with a commodity money system. On the other hand, the commodity money system has its advantages. I'm not totally arguing against it, but I guess I'm arguing for plurality. One advantage of the commodity money system is that when you've got the money, you know you've got it. It's not a promise of something. It's something that should be valuable in its own right. And that's particularly good, as David Graeber pointed out, in times of insecurity or in a country where you might not trust the government. You might want to have an asset currency that's really valuable. So the question has many, many angles and dimensions, but I've touched on a couple there. And I'll hand it back to you, Tom.
Thank you, Matthew. That was excellent. And what you just said actually leads on very nicely to our first question, which is from Jose. And his question is, how does the system save money, for example, for future retirement? Is it capable of doing that? Or do we have to buy something like houses or commodities to ensure our long-term economic security?
So this is what I call the store of value question. Money has traditionally, according to William Stanley Jevons, four functions, or you can simplify it down to two: the medium of exchange and the store of value. And these two functions can be seen at one or other end of a spectrum. Because if you think about it, when you use money as a medium of exchange, you hold it for a short period of time. You sell something, you get the money, and then you buy something with the money. And so even when you're using money as a medium of exchange, you're actually using it to store value for a short period of time. And so even when you use money for a long period of time, eventually you want to spend it. And in theory, at least, because that not all money is eventually spent. In theory, at least, that even when you're using money as a store of value, it's also a medium of exchange. So imagine that spectrum. And now you want to save money for about 40, 50, 60 years. Well, if the money is credit money, then you need to find someone to lend it to for that time, and they will pay you back when you need it 40, 50, 60 years later. And if you think about it, that's kind of what the pension system does. You have this money, you save the money, you put it away, but the money doesn't sit in the bank. It's actually being lent to somebody. And then you bring the money back when you need it. And so you have this long running contract, some legal vehicle that enables you to do that. So that's how credit money serves as a store of value. It's in combination with borrowers, because the money doesn't exist. It's only an arrangement that you give somebody the credit and they give it back later. It's much easier to visualize with a commodity currency, but again, both systems have advantages and disadvantages. So with a commodity currency, you can get a load of gold, say, stash it away underground and then spend it when you get old. And it will still be there and it will probably still be worth something. That system has a disadvantage because if you think of the gold as an asset, then you've actually locked it away. You've taken this asset out of the economy where it cannot be used for all that time. And so storing a commodity currency, I think of it as a bit antisocial. It's like having a resource and not using it, or you know, using it for a store of value. That's kind of not using it. So I think that's a fairly complete answer to the question. Do you agree, Jose?
Yeah,
and that's a credit commons answer. So that's just a mutual credit answer and a credit money answer. It doesn't really touch on the credit commons particularly.
And it is a very important point because, of course, you know, as we all know, there are trillions of dollars sitting, you know, in offshore tax havens doing absolutely nothing. And there's no shortage of problems that money could be put to good use solving. But our economic system is structured in such a way that the people who own those assets have no incentive to put them to any good use. And so I think, yeah, that is a very interesting point. And so Jose has just sent to me in the chat that one possible way, in fact, would be to invest in companies or cooperatives. And I think I'm starting to get my head around within the credit commons model. But from what I understand, one possible way of funding social services would be through the transaction fees which are levied within a mutual credit club. And in this way, you can imagine, apart from keeping wealth local so that, you know, a pension is not something which is being invested and possibly lost, which you're going to be relying on for your retirement, but in actual fact, you know, is being lent out for all sorts of things you may or may not approve of. In this model, provision of social security is managed at a much more local scale through a system where you can't simply speculate it away. And I might have mangled that horribly, so I'm going to pass over to Matthew.
Usually, Tom, the transaction fees that each node might collect is thought of as maintenance fees, administration costs for running the system. I want to distinguish between that and what you said, because a system will always have running costs, and transaction fees or membership fees are the obvious ways of doing it. But when it comes to a system of redistribution, you have to have a policy for doing that and a process of governance. Michael, can you mute yourself, please?
Hi, sorry. I wanted to jump in and ask you a question, and I'm on a phone and I'm unable to find how to use the chat. So I just unmuted myself, but I didn't actually mean to interrupt you.
Okay, well, I've finished my point, so let's hear your question.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I was just to try and understand MMT a little bit more deeply. And in your recent email, I think you said that MMT can't deliver what its advocates kind of suggest it can. So I'm trying to, my question, I suppose, is sort of two parts. MMT seems to be quite undefined often. So kind of trying to get a bit more of an understanding of how we might define it. And also your views on why it can't really deliver what it promises to deliver. So okay. I have to say my basic understanding of it is that it's about money creation and whether governments or private sector create that money, and that has all sorts of implications throughout the economy. So, okay, thanks. I'll just mute myself again.
So MMT is a way of trying to bring the government back to the credit theory of money and convincing the government that it has the power of credit and it shouldn't be borrowing the money from the banks to which it gives the power of credit. The reason that I don't think it can deliver what's promised is that usually MMT is bundled alongside discourse of the Green New Deal. And the Green New Deal is promising that if we could create all this new money, we could spend it on green infrastructure. And it's that green infrastructure which in particular cannot deliver what's promised. So however much money we could spend, we would not be able to green the economy in a way that enables us to sustain our current lifestyles. And I believe there's sufficient work being done on this. And the politicians are in denial because these opinions don't get votes. I still think that MMT would be a great leap forward, to use a communist metaphor, for governments in the way that they think about money and in the way that they take back sovereignty from the corporations who currently seem to tell them everything that they should be doing, not to mention lending them money and profiting from it. So I would very much like to see governments back in the saddle, as it were, because at least we have some say over what happens in government, in theory.
And Noel has just asked a question which I think follows on from that quite nicely, which is, what are your impressions on different public banking models for the circulation of credit? And you've just drawn this distinction between our current system where credit is issued privately versus what MMT advocates, whereby the government issues it. And so it'll be very interesting to hear what your impressions of these different models are in more detail.
So public banking, again, it would be a step forward. It says essentially that the banking system as we know it, it's all private banks, it's done for private profit. And instead, the government could be starting banks, not in order to fund the National Health Service or something like that, because that's very central government, but in order to fund more local activities of, I think, the states and the citizens. And the idea is that the profits that would come from the interest would therefore be churned back into the economy rather than given to rich individuals and presumably siphoned out of the economy and put into tax havens. So it seems to be a very progressive move, and I'm very pleased to see the progress being made in the United States on that front. Is that a sufficient answer?
Over to you, Noel. Did that cover your question? Okay, I've got another question from Jose, which is, how do you establish a unit of account? This seems to be a big issue with a lot of these systems, except time banking, where of course the unit of account is just 1 hour.
Well, the unit of account in history has always been very, very easy because it's declared by the sovereign and used as a standard. The question of the unit of account is very different to the question about who issues the money. So the unit of account is like the meter or a kilogram. it's a measurement, and we can just use the one that's available to everybody. That would be the case certainly if we started commercial systems that already have to deal with national units of account. There is, of course, a lot of politics when you start to imagine other units of account. And we could argue, for example, that the dollar is an inflationary thing. That's good or bad. We could argue that we should really be measuring our value in something concrete, as the gold and silver people do. We could argue that the unit of account should be designed to be stable against a certain market, because you can't imagine, it can't be stable against nothing or everything. You can only stabilize it against something. And so you can make baskets of goods with which to define the unit of account. And just be clear that if you define the unit of account with a basket of goods, you don't have to store those goods somewhere. That's not the same as backing the money with those goods. It's just to say that this unit of account will buy that much of these goods on this market, and therefore it's stabilized to those goods in this market. There are arguments to say that the unit of account doesn't have to be stable. For example, the demurrage argument, the negative interest, the rusting money, says that if the value of your money is going down, you'll want to spend it, and that circulation is good, certainly good for growth. It might not be so good for the environment. That's a paradox we have to deal with these days. So that's just an introduction to some of the questions around the unit of account. But for me, it's just not a big question. I'm looking to impact the real economy, and to do that, we'll use the economy's prevailing unit of account, which is different in different countries. Exchange rates might be a more interesting question, because you have to continuously adjust the exchange rates. But let's see if anybody asks that question.
Does it happen? I think Howard has asked something quite similar. He's just asked, first of all, how active are the existing Unity Forge CES communities? Have there been any requests by the communities for the interledgerability offered by the Credit Commons Federation? And of course, when you're networking together these groups in different countries, you do have to come up with some way of forming an exchange rate for their different units of account.
Okay, so that's three questions. I might get lost halfway through. How popular are those systems? Well, they number many hundreds. And there are other systems. I built a map on creditcommons.net/map where I'm trying to take data from all the systems which are sharing servers. So, you know, pick up 50 or 100 sites at a time and dump them on the map. Those groups tend to be ranging from the size of 20 to 150 people. The larger ones in particular, the users might not all be very active, and they might not register a lot of transactions every month. Sometimes no more than a handful. Some are considerably busier. But the amount of transactions doesn't necessarily reflect the activity of the community, because the accounting is just one facet of any given community. So very often those communities in those networks, they come together for the purpose of doing accounts and kind of economic or quasi-economic cooperation. But then once they do that, then other levels of sociability come out. So it's very hard and probably not fair to look at those communities just through the lens of accounting. The next question was, have they demanded to trade between each other? Some of them do more than others. Some of them have a kind of ideology that says this is a local currency and we don't want to trade with anybody else because it's ours and we want to support our local economy. I take the opposite position that says, yes, this is a locally issued currency And as such, it represents a kind of local sovereignty. But currency isn't very useful unless you can spend it further than your immediate circle. And it's with that in mind, with the aim of making these local currencies more useful, that I've put so much time and effort into the interoperability question over the last decade. CES actually beat me to it by about a decade. And the reason was because the Australians in CES wanted to have their own web server. And so it's very easy just to clone the web server and move the sites across. But then they couldn't trade with each other, because CES sites could always trade with each other. It was like one big exchange divided into groups, even though they had different currencies. So Tim coded quite rapidly, I believe, Clearing Central, which was an exchange that sits in the middle between the Australian and the South African, or the global server, and it enabled transactions to flow across and kept a third-party record. Similarly, in Catalonia, they didn't clone the software, they built their own, the Integral Thes. They made that in Drupal, and they connected that then to Clearing Central. So CES is now three different systems connected by Clearing Central. I always wanted Clearing Central to be better, so that it would be easier for other groups to connect to it. And the Credit Commons has been that effort. It solves a lot of the governance problems by being a nested structure. So it means that all of CES could be together in one exchange, and then they would be able to trade with all the Time Banks USA or something like that, while each unit could manage its own monetary policy internally. So what was the third question? Exchange rates, I think. All we have to go on is what CES did with exchange rates, which was the idea of a living wage. So each country in CES has a living wage that can be expressed in dollars. And CES has a fairly simple mechanism that calculates the exchange rate so that your living wage in your country is equivalent to my living wage in my country. I think that's a fair way of doing it, but it's not a way that would extend very far in the commercial world. And so we need to have a bit more freedom about how we do exchange rates. But that's good enough for now, and I think it's good enough for all the time banks and lets, although of course it's not for me to say. It's when they join a network, they can work it out for themselves what their exchange rates should be.
I think there's a very interesting point here about the nested structure of the Credit Commons, because of course, as Matthew said, it is about, to a degree, local autonomy and enabling people to democratically control their own currency. But of course, you do want it to be useful outside. And so I'd be interested to hear a full explanation of exactly how that nesting system works. Because I understand within a club, if you have two members who have a history of trading with each other, they build up trust. And on the basis of that trust, they will be willing to extend credit to each other. Whereas, say, for example, you have a club in London, for example, and one of the members wants to buy something from Paris, but the London and Paris clubs themselves do not have a history of trading. How does that trust get built up such that credit from London becomes acceptable and therefore useful in Paris, for example?
Well, trust isn't always built up on the basis of an extended relationship. Very often it's possible through reputation. That's how you would trust your bank to give you your money back, because the bank is known to give everybody's money back whenever they ask, except on rare occasions when they all ask at the same time. So you could be fairly sure if there was a network that was functioning in one country and there was a similar network with similar ethics that functioned in another country, you would probably not hesitate too much to open up a modest credit line with them. Now, you might find that they all hate your country and they want to rip you off, but it just doesn't seem very likely. And it's worth taking the risk sometimes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So it's not like you have to build a one-to-one relationship across some sprawling network. Would it be accurate to say that the reputation of a club is almost a kind of aggregate of the reputations of its individual members? Is that approximately how it works, or is it more nuanced than that?
I would say that the credibility, the credit worthiness of a club is an aggregate of the credit worthiness of its individual members. But I don't know how reputations would spread. I guess we would have to watch and observe.
Well, I suppose systems like eBay have got, you know, several decades of experience in managing, although in a different context, of course, there it is just individual accounts with no kind of federation. But as you say, we'll have to watch and learn, and it will be an interesting thing to see how that emerges, and how, I guess, that comes back to governance, really, doesn't it? How do you make sure that the people you're dealing with are trustworthy?
I've always felt that in the framing of the solidarity economy, plus the climate emergency, plus the extreme right-wing / populist direction of government and the power going to corporations, the people who want to create alternatives have to trust each other. We don't have time to build up years and years of trading reputation amongst each other. A leap of faith is the only way that we can aggregate in any meaningful way.
Yeah, and coming back to this kind of question of, you know, we don't have time, you know, we are in a climate and ecological emergency. And of course, the economic system is in meltdown and there's spiraling inequality. There are so many problems at this point that, you know, pretty much everyone accepts things have to change. And one of the things I'm very interested in from a systemic point of view is, of course, with mutual credit, one of the kind of positive aspects of it is that it does incentivize quite directly a circular economy through relocalization of trade. And that could perhaps shorten supply chains and therefore reduce the environmental impact of economic activity. But one of the things I'm very, very interested in is what are the kind of more indirect impacts which an economy with a lively mutual credit sector could have? Could it lead to any kind of cultural change which might help us to be less damaging and live a more sustainable life?
I do think so. And I blogged on creditcommons.net/blog about that only the other day. There's a very interesting, maybe not important, question around how the currency design influences society. If you look at a positive money website, for example, they had a little thing going, change money, change the world. And I'm not sure that that's the case. I used to think it was the case, but the more I've looked at around the subject of money and sociology and politics, international power plays and things, the more I see that the money system reflects the power structures in particular and the needs of elites to extract value from everybody else. And I'm not sure it's possible to change money in order to change the world. It might be the case that we have to change the world in order to change money. And that if we change the world, then the money would just change by itself. It could be that monetary policy is the wrong lever to pull. Nonetheless, that's the lever which I'm committed to pulling. And there is evidence sociologically and psychologically that the way that we interact with money influences our society, influences our state of mind, and so on. So it's probably a two-way relationship. And so it's worth pulling on the lever of money, but it doesn't mean that things will change. It might mean that when the time is ripe for change, if I've been pulling on this lever, it might be more visible.
Well, perhaps it's just because I'm quite new to this, but you know, I'm maybe a bit more optimistic because, you know, as Matthew said, you know, we all know that what happens in society overwhelmingly reflects the priorities of elites. But at the same time, you know, those priorities are shared by very, very few people. I seem to remember reading an article in The Guardian a few months ago, which said that only about 6% of people want to return to business as usual after the coronavirus crisis. So I'm optimistic there is real appetite. And hopefully, you know, Matthew's work will make that lever more and more visible, and we'll have more and more people coming along and saying, actually, yeah, this makes sense. It looks good. I want to be a part of this. But I guess we shall have to wait and see.
I'm talking as well, Tom, about the kind of conviviality that's experienced by people in Let's. So it is possible to create money systems, or maybe more generally, social systems in which people feel better and relate to each other in a different way. And it has been shown by psychologists that when you expose people to money subliminally or remind them of money, they behave in a different way as a consequence. And so we can say that the relationship we have with money now, which may or may not be a consequence of the design of the money itself, makes us feel bad, makes us competitive, and makes us selfish. And so just from that point of view, it's very worthwhile to not only experiment with different forms of money and different social organizations, but to do them for our own benefit and well-being, let alone making them available to other people.
Sorry, Tom, I'm having a problem here with trying to type in questions. So is it okay if we just ask a question from here?
Absolutely, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just wondering, I just mentioned earlier on, we talked about the public banking and different models of banking. But as we know, coming around the corner fairly shortly, we have Brexit. And I see things might be happening with the way the ECB works and the Bank of England. Is there going to, will the private banking system in the UK suffer in any way as far as its size, its volume, where it can lend to? Just your impressions of what might happen there in the City of London.
I can't say much about that. I haven't studied very much the relationship between the pound and the euro. Suffice to say that not being in the euro will make Brexit considerably simpler, and that we already have in Britain our own monetary policy. Even though it's bound, there are some constraints when we joined the euro that said the basis on which money can be created. But there is some freedom. I think in the Maastricht Treaty, there's something that says central banks can only buy bonds from commercial banks, something like that. I don't know if that'll be relinquished. I hope so.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, are there any more questions? We're just coming up to the end of the hour, but we've certainly got 5 or so minutes for a kind of open chat and discussion, if that's what people would like to do. No more questions? Okay, I won't pick on anyone in that case. Right, so it seems like it's kind of come to a natural conclusion. And I guess, you know, what Matthew said just a few minutes ago, to me that's very optimistic that, you know, the way people behave around these different systems is much more positive. And I think, you know, if we can do anything which redesigns the system, which incentivizes and allows people to behave in a way which is more deep down how they'd clearly like to, that's got to be a good thing, really. I think one of the other collaborators on the neutral credit project me and Matthew are working with said that, you know, for many people, money feels more real than physics. And of course, if we're showing that it's not, that, you know, that can only be a good thing. I'd like to re-emphasize that sense of optimism, which I've certainly found since discovering the whole mutual credit movement. And I'm very pleased to be working with Matthew, trying to bring this Credit Commons idea to life. So thank you very much, Matthew. And thank you very much, everyone, for joining us. Matthew, have you got anything you'd like to say